I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. And I want to thank everyone who had the opportunity to listen to seasons one about Isaiah Nixon and two about A.C. Hall. What we're doing today, in between seasons, is something very unique. It's a story that involves the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. If you're not familiar with it, you should know that it's dedicated to victims, victims of white supremacy in America, and in particular, the thousands of black people who were lynched. The opening of the memorial and a nearby museum in 2018 drew crowds and worldwide attention.
The Legacy Museum and Memorial provides a mirror to face some of the ugliness in this country's past. For there's no way we can heal until we first acknowledge and address our wounds.
It's a striking open-air pavilion with hundreds of suspended steel columns, each engraved with names. Altogether, 4,000 names. I've been there. It's inspiring beyond words. Now, as you know, Buried Truths is produced by WABE in Atlanta. And one of their reporters, Stephanie Stokes, also visited the memorial a few months after it opened. And as she scanned the memorials and the monuments, she saw a case she'd never heard of before, one centered here in Atlanta. So I've asked Stephanie here to Bury Truth to talk about it.
Hi, Hank. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. So there are a lot of names on the memorial for the lynching victims in Fulton County, Georgia, and that is Atlanta. And there are dozens of people who were murdered in what we now think of as the 1906 race massacre. In the past, it's been known as the 1906 race riot. Why did this one case end up getting your attention?
Right. I remember looking at the memorial or the column with all of the names for Fulton County and seeing how many there were and being a little surprised by that, honestly. But then I looked at the dates and did notice that most of them did come from the race riot in 1906, which I had heard about because I read a lot of Atlanta history. It's something I care about. And I also do a lot of stories that involve history and racial discrimination. But after all of those names for the race riot, there was a couple names I'd never heard of, and one in particular was from the city of Atlanta, and the person died in 1936. His name was Thomas Finch. And as you know, at the memorial, there isn't any other information about the people. It's just their name and the day they died. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to learn more.
And before we play the radio documentary you did on this man, I'm just wondering, how did you learn about what happened to him?
Right. Well, first I went into the newspaper archives. I started with the Atlanta Constitution, which at the time in the 1930s was mainly for white readers. And the story they had about Thomas Finch read a lot like a police report. It said that Thomas Finch was accused of raping a white woman, and police arrested him. But then, according to the police, he tried to escape. He reached for an officer's gun, and that officer shot him, he said, in self-defense.
Self-defense. Seems like I've heard that a lot. In seasons one and seasons two, we talk about how the two white men who showed up at Isaiah Nixon's farm on the day he voted, claimed that they shot him in self-defense in front of his entire family. Okay, and in season two, A.C. Hall, what did the police who shot and killed him say? It was in self-defense. We hear that a lot.
Right, even today. And what I thought was really interesting about Thomas Finch and his case was in the 1930s, if you read newspapers that were written primarily for a black audience, there was a different story. Mm-hmm. They were much more critical of the police's perspective. And in fact, they actually did reporting where they interviewed his family. And their coverage inspired a civil rights organization that we don't really know about now. It was called the Commission on Interracial Cooperation. This group looked into Thomas Finch's case, and I found their report. It had never been published, and it said that Atlanta police lynched Thomas Finch.
That's you've done a great deal of excavation of history here. I know the cold cases that we've worked on and Barry Truce really are more current. I mean, they're 1940s and 50s and 60s. Yours goes back to 1936. That poses some challenges. How do you go about looking into that history?
Right. It was difficult, and there's only so much information you can find. But I wasn't just interested in the details of what happened. I really wanted to find the people who are around now, the descendants of the lynching victim and the other people involved in the case. And the first person I reached was Thomas Finch's niece. Her name is Joyce Finch Morris.
Hi, Stephanie. My name is Joyce Finch Morris, and I am returning your call. This is related to my uncle, Thomas Finch.
Joyce doesn't sound surprised to hear from me. A student at Northeastern University had contacted her about Thomas Finch's case the year before. We set up a time to go over the research I've gathered. She lives in her childhood home in Atlanta's Grove Park neighborhood. It's an old stone schoolhouse.
Hi, how are you?
Good, are you Joyce?
Oh, yes, I am.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Come in.
She's decorated the place with paintings she's collected over the years, mostly by African-American artists, and mementos from her travels around the world. Joyce is dressed carefully. She's formal, a little subdued, but she doesn't hesitate to answer any questions about her life and her family, although she says there's a lot she doesn't know. She tells me she moved back to Atlanta only a few years ago.
Do you like Atlanta?
Not really. I left Atlanta because I really did not like it. I grew up in the 50s and the 60s. And when I would go to other places, when I would go to D.C. or go to New York or L.A., I didn't see some of the restrictions that I experienced here.
Restrictions like having to use the back door at the movie theater. Joyce's family was part of the city's black middle class, but the realities of segregation were still there. And she says in places like New York, she just thought there was more culture.
The theater, the museums. What I wanted out of New York, Atlanta just didn't have.
She moved to New York in her 20s and started a career in finance and community development. She ended up away from Atlanta for 50 years. Today, Joyce regrets she never got around to asking her parents for more of their history. She remembers when she was young, she tried to learn about her dad's brother, Thomas. He died more than a decade before she was born.
But it was not something that was discussed. And I, like I said, I could understand. Too painful, perhaps.
Her mom was the only one who talked about her uncle's death.
My mother said that he was lynched because he was dating someone white. But that's all I knew. I didn't know any details about how and who did it.
I open up my laptop on her dining room table, and I realize I have more information about this part of the family's history than Joyce. We start scrolling through the documents.
Now, what year was this?
1936.
Oh, my goodness.
We look at the report I found by a civil rights group called the Commission on Interracial Cooperation. The commission's work isn't widely known today, but in the early part of the 20th century, it fought against lynching, along with groups like the NAACP. Although the commission's leaders were mainly white.
Can you make it just a little larger?
Yeah.
The report says Thomas Finch was an orderly at Grady, Atlanta's oldest public hospital. One day, a white patient named Ozella Smith accused him of taking her into a closet and raping her. Thomas's white coworkers didn't believe the assault could have happened. For one, the closet where it allegedly took place was an earshot of doctor's offices.
A small closet.
According to the commission, this is what happened next. Two Atlanta police officers came to the hospital to find out where Thomas lived, but they didn't go to his home right away. They waited hours until 3 a.m. When they showed up, they weren't alone. The Finch family noticed several other people, it's not clear who, standing behind the two officers.
Oh my goodness.
They arrested Thomas, but never took him to the police station. Instead, about an hour later, they brought him to Grady Hospital. He had been beaten and shot. I show Joyce her uncle's death certificate.
So you can see the cause of death here.
Gunshot wounds of the neck, chest, and abdomen. He was 27.
Yeah.
Wow.
The commission's report concludes that Thomas Finch was wrongfully accused of rape and then lynched. But there's another important detail. I show Joyce a newspaper story from more than a decade after Thomas's death. It's about the Atlanta police officer who shot him, claiming it was in self-defense. His name, Samuel Roper.
This is in 1949.
Oh, he was a cake. He was a Klansman.
The article says Roper became the national leader of the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, so I guess that shouldn't surprise anybody.
Joyce seems calm, but I see her scrunching her eyebrows at times, trying to make sense of all this. Then her thoughts shift to the present.
The question is, where can this all lead? I mean, could he be exonerated after the fact? I have no idea.
Like, as a family member, is that something that you would want?
If he was innocent, of course, yes. If it could be proven that he was murdered and the people responsible are dead, I'm sure, but if the record could be cleared or clarified, I would say yes, I'd go for it.
This is a new question that I hadn't thought of. What would it take to set the record straight in a case that happened 80 years ago? I tell Joyce I'll let her know if I uncover anything more. I go back into the city records. I check notes from the police committee from the week he died, board minutes from Grady Hospital. Nothing about Thomas Finch or the commission's investigation into his death. It doesn't seem like the report was even made public. His death is forgotten so quickly that I worry I've missed something. I go to E.M. Beck.
Okay. I am E.M. Beck, a professor emeritus of sociology, and a Josiah Meggs distinguished teaching professor emeritus at the University of Georgia.
He's one of the only professors I reach who has a record of Thomas Finch's case, and he would. He spent the last few decades developing a lynching database. I ask him why the city never followed up on the commission's findings. I know most rural lynchings never got a thorough review, but I also thought, you know, this is Atlanta. This is the city of Atlanta. Couldn't something happen that might not be able to happen elsewhere in the South?
Well, I mean, you think about it this way. It's all white power structure. And so you've got to ask, what is it in their interest to try to pursue these things? And especially if it involves the police. And I would say that they have no interest in it.
The police involvement apparently made the NAACP uneasy, too. In a letter, the group's director, Walter White, didn't want to call Thomas's case a lynching, at least at first. Professor Beck says the history of police and lynchings is murky. He can think of maybe 30 cases like Thomas's. There could be more. The problem is, the only written records are the officers' own reports.
I mean, the one thing that we know, at least after the revival of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1915, is that one of the things that the Klan did was try to recruit policemen.
Policemen like Samuel Roper. I learned he wasn't the only Atlanta officer loyal to the Klan in the 1930s. This tape is from an oral history interview with former Atlanta Police Chief Herbert Jenkins. He was talking to the late historian Cliff Kuhn.
Well, I almost say that most of the members at one time, most of the members of the police department were members of the Ku Klux Klan. And there was some officers in the Klan. There was also officers in the Atlanta Police Department.
Yep, the Atlanta Police Department was full of Klan members in the 1930s. It gets me thinking about other police shootings from the time, like the officer who was with Roper the night Thomas died. I see that he killed at least 5 black men in his career. In one case, he used a machine gun. But so many years later, there's no evidence to prove these were anything other than officer-involved shootings. That's what makes Thomas Finch's case stand out, as Professor Beck says.
I think the case there of Thomas Finch, it becomes, especially with the report done by the CIC, the Commission on Interracial Cooperation, in fact, suggests that, he would fall into the definition of what a lynching would be.
The commission's investigation into Thomas's death is the most reliable information I may ever have. But again, the documents aren't all I'm interested in. There are still other families I need to talk to. The families of Ozella Smith, the woman who accused Thomas Finch of rape, and of Samuel Roper, the police officer.
Stephanie's going to do just that in a minute. This is Hank Klibanoff, and this is Buried Truths.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org. Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
It's easy to trace Roper's life and career. He served in the Atlanta Police Department, then moved up the ladder, way up the ladder, to lead the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, meaning he was one of the state's top law enforcement officers. After that, in the late 1940s, he took over the national leadership of the Ku Klux Klan. I look up Roper's obituary, and from there, I'm able to find his grandson, Kent Giles. We talk a few times. He's never heard of Thomas Finch, and he's reluctant to do an interview. But after he goes over my research, he agrees, and I drive to his house in Marble Hill, a rural area north of Atlanta. Kent is ready for me. He's arranged all the documents I gave him on his dining room table, along with a small pad where he's written down notes. He's friendly, but when I turn on the recorder, the room feels tense.
So you were kind of nervous about being misrepresented in this story. I was curious, would you want to talk about that at all?
Well, I just think that there's always a risk by association. I think most people understand that none of us are our ancestors. If we go far enough back, we all have ancestors that did things good and bad.
Kent says he knew his grandfather. Roper lived until he was 90. They would talk about his service in the First World War and his career in law enforcement, and eventually, the Klan. Kent says his grandfather only joined to get ahead in politics. He remembers asking about the violence the hate group is known for.
And I said, you know, when you were head of the KKK, which was actually, I think he was a Grand Imperial Wizard, maybe a total of a year to 18 months, so it wasn't very long. He said that he never condoned lynching. And newspapers report him as saying that, you know, we will consider our political activism for white supremacy, but we will not, you know, condone violence.
I saw an article where Roper said the Klan did not condone violence. But I tell Kent about another article, one where the Klan was accused of bombing the homes of black families in Atlanta. Roper was in charge then. Kent says his grandfather blamed that kind of violence on fringe members. He compares his grandfather to Georgia Governor Eugene Talmadge. He was a Klan sympathizer who, by the way, fought to keep black people from voting.
Now, there's no question their politics was segregationist. It was white supremacist. They were staunchly anti-communist. Most of the things that I understood about them and about that era were political things. These were men who were enforcing the law and getting elected and in high office. They weren't men who really, you know, wanted to act like criminals.
So what does Kent make of Thomas Finch's case then? He goes through the commission's report point by point.
Yeah, it's a lot of detail, but
he says he agrees with the commission that there are aspects of the case that seem off, like the police arresting Thomas at 3 a.m., while the commission saw all this as a police-sponsored lynching, Kent comes to a very different conclusion.
What I read into this event is that the police were concerned that there was going to be a lynching or some kind of activity either by the accuser's family or some racist group in town.
In other words, Kent believes his grandfather was trying to protect Thomas Finch from a mob, not conspiring with one. Then he thinks Thomas tried to escape and reached for his grandfather's gun. This is what the officers claimed at the time. Still, Kent says he can totally see why others might side with the commission's account. I tell him, yeah.
For a lot of people, right, if they hear that there was a case that from the 1930s that a civil rights group said was probably a lynching, and then they hear that the shooter involved was later the leader of the Ku Klux Klan in the South, they're probably going to feel pretty certain about what happened, that it was a lynching, right? I mean, would you tell those people that they're wrong?
Well, I think that, I think all of us have to be honest and say we're viewing the world through certain filters. So I would say to them, you know, I'm viewing this through as much truth as I can find, which there's a lot of missing pieces, and through the filters of a man I knew. The only thing I can say truthfully is I don't know what really happened, and I don't think we're ever going to really know what happened.
Thomas Finch died more than 80 years ago. None of the witnesses are alive. Still, there's one more person I'm interested in, the woman, Ozella Smith. I have a little trouble tracking her after the case. She died in the 1980s with a different first name. I managed to locate her niece, Dolores Sharp. She agrees to meet me at a library near her home in Peachtree City, south of Atlanta. Like Kent Giles, Dolores is cautious. We spend a couple of hours going over documents before she's okay to talk on the record. Dolores says she grew up around her aunt. She saw her any time she went over to her grandma's house. Ozella Smith lived there. She never married.
When did you first hear the story that I called you about?
She had heard of the case, at least part of it.
Oh, I was a young girl when I was told that my aunt was raped by a black person at the hospital. I never really knew a lot of details, and because it was taboo to talk about, you didn't bring it up. And I don't know why. I was mature in a sense that I felt like maybe it was something that I didn't need to plunder into.
She says the assault was just too painful for her family to talk about.
Oh, I think it was maybe a major event that permanently scarred the heart and the mind of the members that were closest to my aunt.
I can hear the conviction in her voice when she talks about this family history, so I'm not surprised when Dolores is disturbed when she reads the commission's conclusion that Thomas Finch was wrongfully accused. The implication is that her aunt lied about the assault.
When you hear something contrary to what you grew up believing, you might even go on a defense of that, or you might take the attitude that she was just completely discarded, that her, what happened to her was completely irrelevant.
She doesn't get to complete her thought. A Peachtree City librarian motions through the glass of the study room. Our time is up. Dolores says we can reschedule, but weeks go by and she never does agree to another meeting. This isn't what I expected to hear from the other families. Somehow, after all my research, I thought there might be consensus on how we should look at Thomas's case. But there isn't. I talked to Catherine Meeks. She's a former African-American studies professor who now directs the Absalom Jones Center for Racial Healing in Atlanta.
I've realized that I was just so naive going into this that I was so surprised to have disagreement about something that happened 80 years ago. And I just wondered if we can't agree about that, like, what can we agree about now?
We don't agree about the history. We don't agree about the written history of the United States.
Professor Meeks says lynching in particular is a point of shame.
That's one piece of the history that we've tried the hardest to ignore. We'll talk about slavery, we'll talk about Jim Crow, we'll talk about Reconstruction, but we don't really want to talk about lynching.
Many places in Georgia still don't want to talk about lynchings, even though there were more lynchings here than in any other state except Mississippi. There are exceptions. A couple of years ago, I drove out to the city of LaGrange in West Georgia, where the police chief had called a community meeting. 200 people crowded into a Methodist church. Chief Lou Dekmar spoke about Austin Calloway, who was killed in 1940 when a mob stormed the city jail.
I sincerely regret and denounce the role our police department played in Austin's lynching, both through our action and our inaction. And for that, I'm profoundly sorry. It should never have happened.
His comments received a standing ovation and drew national attention. But in Thomas Finch's case, it doesn't seem like authorities have any plans to apologize. I let the city of Atlanta and the police department know about what I found. I sent emails, even registered letters. Would they acknowledge his case as a lynching? Atlanta's police chief, Erica Shields, wouldn't talk to me. The office of Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms only gave a short written statement. It says the city has no official record of Thomas's case, but there is no denying that Atlanta, quote, still wears scars from the deep wounds inflicted during that dark chapter of history. And this surprises me, too. Atlanta's very different now. The all-white power structure is gone. It's had black mayors for decades, and the police force is majority black. But when it comes to Thomas Finch's case, they still have little to say. I ask Catherine Meeks about this.
Well, I just think it's denial of the history. I think it's they don't want to take responsibility. They may even be worried that if they say something, they will be admitting to some culpability that might leave them in legal trouble.
Meek says it doesn't matter if the people in power have changed. The institutions still need to recognize what happened.
It's not as important for me for somebody to go stand up in front of a microphone and say, I'm sorry, as it is for them to really be awake, to really understand, and to really do something. But if you're doing all of that, you probably don't mind saying you're sorry.
For now, the most public acknowledgement of Thomas Finch's death is still in another state, the place where I first came across his name, the Memorial for Lynching Victims in Montgomery, Alabama. Several months after we first met, I joined Joyce at the memorial. She's on a civil rights tour with a couple of friends. We walk down into the lower level of the main pavilion, past a wall with streaming water. Hundreds of steel columns shaped like coffins are hanging above us. They're organized by the counties where the lynchings happened.
Forsyth County.
Joyce is moving quickly. She seems anxious, almost excited. We find the column that includes Atlanta. It's so high above us that Joyce strains to make out the names of the victims etched on the column.
Can you see it?
I really can't. And actually, that might be good because I don't want to start crying.
So my photographer takes a picture of Thomas's name and enlarges it on the screen of his camera.
So just to give you context, mm-hmm. It's the bottom right mm-hmm. here.
Thomas Finch.
She and her friend stare at the image. Then Joyce approaches me.
I'm really reserved most of the time when I hold my feelings in. I never knew my uncle, but I can pass this along to my family members, the ones who are still alive, and to my grandkids. And
she pauses, like she's taking in what's around her. Her uncle's name among more than 4,000 other African Americans who were lynched in this country.
I mean, this is history. I mean, he's memorialized. And he's not forgotten. I didn't even know him. You know, I really didn't. But it's important.
We step outside the pavilion and see another set of the columns lined up on the ground. They're duplicates. The people behind the memorial want to send them to the counties where the lynchings happened, sort of like historical markers. In Atlanta, there's a private group working to make that happen. It would finally bring Thomas Finch public recognition in the city where he was killed more than 80 years ago. After spending all this time on his case, I can't say how that effort will be received.
Stephanie Stokes is a reporter with WABE. This story was produced in partnership with the podcast Reveal, and it was supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Stephanie, I'm so happy to have you here. And one thing that I just sort of hung up in my mind is that this all begins with a curious reporter walking through this memorial in Montgomery and seeing all these names and just zeroing in on one of them, Thomas Finch. And as a result, you prevent him from disappearing. Tell me about that and the importance that that has.
Well, first I would say, of course, that the memorial, I think, did the first step toward preventing him from disappearing into history, even though his name was just one among more than 4,000 names there. But that is something that I ended up thinking about a lot with this story, is how close Thomas Finch was to being completely forgotten outside of the members of his family. In fact, something that's not included in the story is really the only reason why the memorial included his name and why I was able to do this story is because his family originally spoke up when he died. From what I can tell in newspaper clippings, his family protested his case, talked to black newspapers. The father said he wanted an investigation into his son's death.
You know, I find these days when there's a family that feels there's an injustice and that someone's been shot and killed unfairly without justification, etc., the families frequently will show up in the media. They'll have press conferences. It was remarkable what the Finch family did and put themselves in jeopardy as a result, right?
Yeah, that's something that I thought about in this story. I think it's easy now to not be impressed by that because we do see it so often in the media. But if you think about this time, this is the 1930s. When 1930s, Atlanta is a city, but it's still in the South. And these are dangerous times for people who are black, people who are speaking up. So I was really impressed by that. And I tried to ask the niece of Thomas Finch, Joyce Finch Morris, about that. And she said she did remember that that her grandfather was really outspoken, and that her dad, too, who would have been Thomas Finch's brother, that he also went on to be very active in the NAACP in Atlanta. And she said he was really bothered by anything that he saw as unfair.
On the other side, let's talk a little bit about Sam Roper. I mean, here's a man who, as you point out, was a police officer who then rises up through the ranks. He later becomes the head of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And the whole time, he's quite publicly in the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes, he was the public face of the organization.
But listeners of the first season may recall, particularly in the trailer, that there's a scene, Eugene Talmadge, while running for governor, has surrounded himself with people who have been with him when he was governor previously, and in his office, one of the men in his office with him is the exalted Cyclops of the Klan, and that would have been Sam Roper. And there is a scene that was published that came out of that meeting in which one of the witnesses in that meeting said that Talmadge was asked, "Governor, it seems like the Supreme Court says black people are going to be able to vote now in the Democratic Party primary. What are we going to do now, Governor?" And Talmadge ripped off a little piece of paper and wrote a note on it and said, "Pistols." And so I'm trying to say that the same Sam Roper who was involved in the Thomas Finch shooting was the man who was inside that room, according to a published account, when Gene Talmadge said pistols was the answer. And that shows you a remarkable coziness at the time between the Klan and the police and official Georgia officialdom.
It's interesting you point that out because that is something Samuel Roper's grandson, Kent Giles, really emphasized in our conversation. He really felt that his grandfather, Samuel Roper, was the same as Eugene Talmadge, just another politician. When he talked about his grandfather, he would often say, people like my grandfather and Eugene Talmadge and other elected leaders at the time. He really saw the Klan as just another political body. And I think there was an element of that, but you can't ignore the other elements. Like in the story, I asked him about how the Klan, under his grandfather's watch in the newspapers, was accused of bombing the homes of black families who were trying to move into white neighborhoods. And The Klan was accused of burning crosses. The Klan was accused of doing a lot of things. And his grandfather would say, no, that was just fringe. Those were just fringe members, but it was the same organization.
Stephanie, this is terrific. It's good to have you here.
Thanks so much, Hank.
And I want our audience to know that we are continuing to work on Season 3 of Buried Truths. I will tell you that in December, those of you who listened to the Isaiah Nixon story will be glad to know that Isaiah Nixon's widow, Sally, celebrated her 96th birthday. And I was thrilled to spend an afternoon recently with Dorothy Nixon Williams and her daughter, Joy, here in Atlanta. And we will return on the air in a few weeks. I am going to Alabama, and to be honest, I'm going to my hometown, where the library there has invited me to come and to do a podcast from there. And we're going to talk about the history of sort of modern history of race in my hometown. I'm looking forward to it. I'll see some people I know. I'll meet people I don't know. But what we have in common is a shared history that we'll be discussing. Buried Truths is a production of WABE in Atlanta. I'm Hank Libanoff.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.